Welcome to the Democracy Group, a network of podcasts about democracy, civic engagement, and civil discourse. In this feed, you will find a sampling of episodes from our podcast and the Democracy Group, as well as recordings from our events. If you enjoyed this podcast, then please visit democracygroup.org to find more like this. Now let's get to our featured episode.
Hello, I'm Siva Vaidyanathan.
And I'm Nicholas Scott, sitting in for Will Hitchcock.
And from the University of Virginia's Karsh Institute, this is Democracy in Danger.
Protests by women's rights groups, environmentalists, and public workers.
Is he going to do a dramatic shock therapy, or is he going to pursue a gradualist approach?
In Argentina, there are fresh worries about the economy, women's rights, and the authoritarian politics of a new president.
Former Argentinian TV personality Javier Milei, who claims to get advice from his dogs, has been called eccentric by those being polite.
Yeah, and those being less polite call him el loco, the crazy man. Now, Nick, you are a historian of Latin America, so I've been looking forward to getting your take on events in Argentina for some time. Now, I've heard that Milei communes with his dead dog, Conan, and has had him cloned 5 times.
Known for wielding a live chainsaw at his campaign rallies, now the libertarian populist is Argentina's...
No, but even more troubling is his actual agenda. As an expert on Latin America, would you like to fill us in on this agenda?
Sure, and, you know, thank you so much for having me. Now, Milei wants to eliminate the Argentine central bank. He wants to dollarize the economy, and he also wants to get rid of the majority of labor protections. He's also vowed to fire the majority of public sector employees and to outlaw abortion. Now, he calls himself an anarcho-capitalist, which means he's the proponent of a sort of free market radicalism that would allow for stuff like the open sale of human organs.
And calls global warming a socialist lie. His unexpected...
But Argentines love him for this?
Well, yes and no. Now, Milei is an incredibly polarizing figure. He's been compared to Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil and Donald Trump here in the United States. The people who love Milei really love him. And he was elected by an 11-point margin.
Wow.
But at the same time, there are massive crowds mobilizing to oppose his policies. For example, thousands took to the streets in Buenos Aires, the capital, on International Women's Day last month. Now, it's not clear if Milei's policies will get very far. His party does lack a majority in the Congress, and the Senate has rejected his austerity measures. Meanwhile, the courts have also suspended his labor decrees, and they argued that the Constitution did not give the president the authority to bypass the legislature.
Well, I'm getting unpleasant flashbacks here, Nick.
Exactly, and that's just skimming the surface. So fortunately for our listeners, we have a couple of guests joining us today from Buenos Aires to go deeper with us on all of these things. Lucia Cholican is a freelance journalist who reports on politics and human rights. Lucia, welcome to Democracy in Danger.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We also have sociologist and activist Veronica Gago, a professor at the University of Buenos Aires. She's the author of several books, including most recently, A Feminist Reading of Debt. And she's a leader of a transnational movement against gender-based violence. It's called Ni Una Menos. Veronica, a warm welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
So let's start with your impressions of the first 100 days of Javier Milei's presidency. So I'm wondering, how would you describe what he's doing and how people are reacting to it? I mean, the economy is in crisis, but, you know, not for the first time in Argentina. And he's added turmoil in a country where, let's be honest, political instability has sort of been the only stable factor, right? So what are people saying and doing, and what are they arguing about, Veronica?
Well, we are in the midst of an economic catastrophe. Inflation records, massive layoffs in the public and private sector, budget cuts, but also cut in food supply to soup kitchens, for example, threat of defunding of the scientific system, defunding of universities, and the list could go on because every day is a new announcement of this kind of shock policies with a speed and violence that we have not seen in the democratic era in Argentina. I am analyzing this political logic from three key points: the capacity of destruction, the generation of chaos, and the display of cruelty. I think these terms are a sort of political grammar of this government that is completely new. I think there is a need to understand Milei's electoral victory and government as catalyzing the rejection of the precarity that existed before and that was made worse by the pandemic, but also by the inflation. Nevertheless, there have been important mobilizations, strikes, and protests. In other words, I want to underline, Argentina is not a society that passively accepts these ultra-neoliberal measures. At the same time, Milei still retains support, but I think many of his voters have already been disappointed by the effects of his measures, because they are feeling in their everyday lives.
Yeah. Lucia, what is your take on Milei's first 100 days? Do you agree with Veronica and how these measures are playing out?
Yes, I think that Milei's first 100 days were split somehow, just as Veronica was saying, on two complementary sides, right? You have on one side the shock economic therapy, and on the other side what he calls, and this is not just Milei, but I would say an international ideology that speaks about a cultural battle against, you know, culture Marxism, socialism, or however you want to call it. And somehow in that category, a lot of things fall that have not necessarily anything to do with Marxism, like public funding for the scientific system, public funding for culture, national culture, federal culture across the provinces. So I would say that over this first 100 days, the economy was definitely at the center of every conversation, because it has been for crazy months. You have to remember that during his first week, he devalued the peso by 54%. The gas prices alone jumped over 100% over the past 4 months, of course, having an impact on prices across every sector. But this cultural battle that he has been leading somehow makes it easier for his voter base to wait, you know, to see the results that he has pledged to deliver right from the very beginning. You know, Milei, during his campaign, he was talking about dollarizing the Argentine economy during his first 10 days in office. That has not been delivered for his people. He has not even taken away the currency caps that were, you know, such at the epicenter of every macroeconomic debate on where Argentina should go. So I agree with Veronica that this has been both a shock and a catastrophe for the society. What I have my doubts on, because for my whole life, not just as a reporter, I always thought, you know, Argentina has a very small margin for this kind of shocks. The Argentine society does not tolerate austerity, does not tolerate these neoliberal policies. This is something that I'm starting to question for myself. And through the reporting that I do, Milei has kept his support. People are still willing to feel the impact of these adjustments and the configuration of our community. And it does not seem like he's coming towards a crisis on his governability. I would say that he's winning the battles that he's giving, most of them, some of them, and people seem to be willing to wait and see what happens. So that's the question we're working with now, right? What's going to happen? How much can people tolerate in these policies until, you know, they start asking for him to deliver?
Yeah, I actually want to dig a little deeper in on this with you both. Now, Milei, as you said, ran on this policy of austerity. He's unleashed this shock doctrine across the country. But this is also a country with, as you say, is a rich tradition of protest and organized labor during the 20th century. And now, Veronica, in your research, you've looked at working class peoples and informal sector economy, such as street vendors or other marginalized groups. And so I'm curious to get your take as, you know, how has Argentina's labor movement and its working classes responded? What are the forms of protestation that we're seeing, and how does it square with what your work shows on neoliberalism and everyday life?
Yes, I think it is important to not make an immediate translation between when we talk about the fascist government, for example, and the idea of the fascism of its voters. I think that it is very easy to say, well, all the people who voted for Milei is fascist or is ultra right wing in their ideology. I think it is not. It is necessary to investigate the subjective support that neoliberal disposition has built to Trump at the ballot boxes and to interpellate especially young and very precarious workers, especially men. And I think that the austerity policies has already been trained for a lot of people, especially in the informalized sectors of workers, a sort of mandate to optimize and monetize our own resources. So we have in Argentina a very strong union movement, and you know that movement called the strike in January, and it was a big demonstration, and they are now, I think, trying to call a new general strike again. And you have also the very interesting experience of union of the informal workers in Argentina. That is a very singular experience here that is also connected with social programs and state subsidies that are also in crisis. So I think it's a paradox because you are voting for a loco, a crazy man who promised to destroy the state, and at the same time, you are part of the most precarized sectors. I think that the extreme austerity that we are living now could be understood as a war against social reproduction of the working class.
Right. Let's talk about the paradox. So, Lucia, you've written about contingent workers, gig workers, delivery people, actually organizing themselves in favor of Milei. So help us understand that. Why do people who are potentially impacted the most negatively by Milei's policies support him?
Well, this is a lot to do with what Veronica was just saying. In Argentina, almost half workers have an informal job, especially after the pandemic. The informality rate spiked, I think, everywhere in the world, but especially in Argentina. And when I reported on gig workers, what struck me the most was unregistered workers didn't seem to discuss their jobs as the chance they took because it was hard to find a job. It was not like, you know, I'm doing Rappi, which is a delivery app, or Uber because I didn't have any other chance, but it was portrayed by many of them as a choice due to the autonomy that the work gave them. And low and mid-class workers that are supporting Milei told me that they didn't want the state intervening in their jobs, telling them that they could only work up to a certain amount of hours, or in their words, keeping their money by taxing their employers. We have to go back a little bit for this. The main talking point of libertarianism in Argentina is the idea of the state being, in Milei's words, a criminal organization stealing from people. They have built the idea that the state is their biggest enemy. These workers who are striped from their rights, and in a country with a huge amount of labor rights and a huge amount of labor history, as you said, the gig jobs were somehow the condensation of several claims that the libertarian ideology has brought to the public debate, including whether historical reforms in Argentina, like workers' rights, severances, and retirements, should work as they do or not. A portion of society, which you would consider very vulnerable, is somehow building the speech of choosing this, and therefore choosing Javier Milei, an anarcho-capitalist, as their leader.
Right.
Yeah, and you know, Veronica, I want to kind of come back to this idea when you were talking about specifically how young men are a target and sort of fit into this. You know, I was very surprised by how many young people turned out to vote for Milei. And so I'm curious about sort of getting a take on how this neoliberal subject making interacts with gender, and how specifically sort of Milei's anti-feminist, or what we could even call his anti-gender agenda sort of spoke to these young men.
Yes, I think it's crucial, that point. It is well established how the vote for Milei has a very important male component, very precarious young male workers. This is partly, I think, of a reaction to feminist advances that the feminist movement in Argentina has achieved in recent years. I think it connects to the frustration of those who are resentful of their future possibilities and humiliated in the concrete materiality of the present everyday life. So the gender agenda or the gender victories in our country are a sort of scapegoat. I think that it's important to analyze, for example, Milei's speech at the Davos Economic Forum. He pointed out the feminist movement and the environmental movement as the main enemies. Milei is targeting this movement also in order to mobilize this frustration and this hate in the young male, very precarious population.
Right. Well, Veronica, let's talk about some resistance to that. You've been involved with this movement Ni Uno Menos, which translates as not one less. How did the movement originate? What does it stand for? And how is it standing up to this effort by the new government to crack down on women's autonomy?
Yes, it is a movement born in 2015 against machista violence, against femicide, and it is a very wide movement organized, especially in certain moments, for example, March 8th. The International Women's Day that we also vindicate as the International Feminist Strike. And it is very well connected with the struggle of the campaign for the abortion rights. And you know that in Argentina, we have the abortion rights as a law since 2020. So the so-called Green Tide, Marea Verde, it is a very world famous movement, also in connection with this Ni Una Menos movements and all other kinds of initiatives and groups and collectives and movements that are part of this big movement. They are building concrete forms of feminism in a very grassroots dynamic. Past March 8, we were like 1 million people in all the country mobilized. And I think it was very important because it was the first March 8 against a far-right government, which denigrated women in general and feminism in particular. We organized ourselves in the face of a new repressive protocol, and we overflowed all the streets, and it was a very well-coordinated action. And maybe a third element that I think it's relevant is because we are in the midst of an economic war against the population, as we were saying before, which makes organizing and mobilizing a huge effort. Mm-hmm. You have to have time, to have money to organize that kind of things. So for all these reasons, the massiveness of the feminist demonstration in the feminist strike, I think it is very important and very impressive.
Now, Lucia, when you and I were emailing ahead of the interview, you had mentioned to me that you thought that the final few weeks of March were going to be so important and sort of vital, as you said, to the future of democracy in Argentina. I was wondering if you could say a little bit more for our listeners. You know, what was so significant about the end of March compared to, say, the massive mobilizations that Veronica was just speaking about at the beginning of March? And what is your take? How do you think that month played out?
Well, it's interesting always to look back. Now in Argentina, we're living in such a complete change all the time that it feels like, you know, February was decades ago, but essentially March is the end of the summer, right? So that's when school starts, when families actually sit down and look at their finance and be like, okay, how much is gas going to cost? How much is a school going to cost for the kids? So it was expected to be a very critical month in terms of economy, the feeling that the middle class would not take the huge changes, especially in their own finances, once that the summer was finally over and they sat down and looked into their economy. And this was actually misinterpretation, I think, that from many reporters, because we were looking at the numbers, and you know, in the history of Argentina, this would have been something completely impossible to tolerate, right? Well, that did not happen.
Right.
We expected, you know, more national strikes, more protests. There have been, of course, and I want to stress that the work that the unions have been doing is really unprecedented. It's so fast and so constant, but it still has not been the kind of impact that we all expected. Right at the beginning of this month, Milei shut down the public news agency, for example. These are movements, leaving a country without a news agency. These are movements that you would expect that would create a very strong impact in essentially on social movements and the organization of the public sector. The massive layoffs that Veronica was talking about, there have been at least 15,000 layoffs in the past 2 weeks in the public sector. We knew that these things were coming. And also there's a very important part of all of this, which is not just March 8, which is, of course, incredibly important for social movements in Argentina, and I would say Latin America, but also March 24, which is the anniversary of the dictatorship and the coup that was installed in 1976 and lasted until 1983. Argentina has a very young democracy. It's only 41 years old. And the anniversary is always a very sensitive day for people across the country. The dictatorship left 30,000 disappeared people whose fates we yet don't know. And all of their relatives and friends and people they knew are still looking for them and demanding to know what happened to them. The dictatorship also kidnapped and stole 500 babies that were born in captivity. These are people that are a little less than 50 years old today, that they don't know about their identity. The struggle of the abuelas and madres of Plaza de Mayo, which has pioneered in the world, is still very strong in Argentina because the families are still asking to know what happened to their loved ones. So March 24 is always a day of not just commemorating what happened, saying never again to authoritarianism and to the dictatorship, but it's also to reinforce the claim of the families and the society that is still looking for answers. So with a denialist government, of course, this was very critical. We did not know what to expect. And I think that, and maybe Veronica, you might disagree, or I don't know, we can discuss it, but it was very interesting to see how it all unraveled, because what the government did was they published a 12-minute video basically challenging the human rights organization's view, talking about the other victims, that is, victims killed by the members of the guerrillas before the coup started. And they claimed that we need to hear the complete truth, which is, in fact, what the Argentine society had as a sole version until the trials were opened at the beginning of the century. So it's very interesting to see how we are hearing this contesting of the narratives around authoritarianism and dictatorship again. And Milei has said many times that the crimes against humanity during the dictatorship were actually excesses in the context of a war. But again, this did not necessarily spark the reaction that at least I expected to see from the society. It still feels like social movements and the opposition to Milei is at some point very paralyzed because of everything that's happening.
Yes, yes. So, Veronica, I'm fascinated by this role of history in the current moment of Argentina. And specifically, I'm curious about your perception of what Lucia was just discussing, the dirty war, all of those years of dictatorship and torture and disappearance, My memory of the resistance to that is striking photos of mothers holding up photos of their children who had disappeared. Where are those mothers now? Is there an articulated acknowledgement that Millet is essentially threatening to bring back the dirty war, the horrible times, that level of oppression? It's, to me, it's baffling that memories so fresh haven't been summoned to resist this movement.
Yes, you know that memory is a political battleground. And I think that is amazing how the mothers, madres y abuelas de Plaza de Mayo are still active. They are organizing different political activities. They march every Thursday in Plaza de Mayo. And I think they are a crucial genealogy if you want to understand the feminist movement in Argentina. Because as Lucia was saying, they are pioneers in that kind of very innovative and very brave political struggles. At the same time, when you are talking about human rights, when you are talking about union rights, for a big part of our population, that seems a sort of abstraction. So there is not a sort of concrete attachment. They are not part of everyday experience because of precarity, because of what we are talking about, neoliberal subjectivation. So Millet is very clever in the way that he reinforces repudiation of rights as privileges. And I think that this is a reason why feminism, but also human rights struggles, continue being uncomfortable for and rejected by this government, very concentrated in this idea of cancellation of history.
Yeah. And, you know, as I'm reflecting here on our conversation today, it seems like one of the big sort of takeaways and themes is paradox, right? The sort of the paradox you point to with his election, the paradox in relation to sort of memory, the paradox in relation to a powerful social movement base, but still seems to be a social movement base that's marginally paralyzed. And so I'd be curious to get both of your takes on sort of how do you see the way forward? How might Argentines and Argentinian society break out of this paradox and move forward in a productive way that could potentially stop Millet's policies from harming a majority of the country?
That's a very complicated question.
Yes.
I think that from what we've seen, not just Javier Millet, but the movement that he represents and the ideas that he represents are challenging the way that we conceived our own society. You know, you always had denialism, you always had libertarian views, you always had the idea that the state was a criminal organization and the social justice is something negative. This is, I would say, the first time that we have all of these ideas being very outspoken and very public from the government at the same time. So it is clear that the Argentine society is at a turning point in terms of its own representation. And it is very hard to answer what the future may bring. And I'm not discussing, you know, the next 10 years. I am talking about the next 6 months. So I think that if there is one thing that we can say about the future is that we all feel like this is not a point of equilibrium. It feels like every day is a different news and a different austerity measure and more layoffs doesn't seem sustainable. The question is to which point it will turn. If it's going to be, you know, okay, this is the new normality and Argentina is a totally different country than it was a year before. Or if the Argentine society sets a limit and says, okay, this is it. This is all we're taking. Now start delivering, start fixing things, start, you know, lowering inflation and start giving us back our rights. We don't know. It is very hard to tell.
I want to underline, I think that Millet is an attempt to colonize the frustration with democracy. We have more than 40% of our population under the poverty line. So that is a very clear and material reality. The other thing that it's important to understand Milei, he has the support of the neo-extractivist corporation. And this is a very important project of recolonization of Argentina. You know that Argentina, with Bolivia and Chile, we are part of the so-called lithium triangle. Mm-hmm. So Milei is flattering Elon Musk, but also companies that are very, well, curious to invest here and to plunder our natural resources. So we have to analyze what are the economic, the material, the strategic support of this kind of government.
Yes, and I want to add one more thing. What happens this year later in the US election is going to be also very important to understand what may happen in countries like ours in the years to come. We are having the direct impact of Trump's ideas and politics, maybe some years later, but we are having them and we are feeling them. And you can see the correlation between the speech of Donald Trump and his movement and what happened later with Jair Bolsonaro and what is happening with Bukele in El Salvador. And this is what we are seeing also right now in the government of Argentina. If Donald Trump wins the election in November, this is going to have a direct impact in the years to come.
Well, Lucia Cholican, Veronica Gago, thank you so much for joining us on Democracy in Danger.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Lucia Cholican is a freelance journalist. Her work has appeared in Rest of the World, the North American Congress on Latin America, and the New York Times.
Veronica Gago is a professor of social science at the University of Buenos Aires and at the National University of San Martin. She is also an activist. Her books include A Feminist Reading of Debt and Neoliberalism from Below, Popular Pragmatics and Baroque Economies.
Democracy in Danger is part of the Democracy Group podcast network. Visit democracygroup.org to find all of our sister shows. We'll be right back.
Nick, I'm so happy you're here with us today. As an expert on Latin American history, I just have so many questions for you, but I'm not going to ask them all, right? So, look, one of the things I'm fascinated by is that we've had two very different stories of neighboring countries at the southernmost tip of South America, right? Chile had a particular story in the 1970s, 80s, 90s, and this decade. And Argentina has had a very different story. You have the sort of the Perón-influenced, heavy-handed quasi-socialism in the 1960s and 70s in Argentina, right? And then in Chile, you have in the 1970s a full-fledged adoption of Chicago school neoliberal economics, right? Where the state is completely receded from economic activity, you know, Social Security barely exists, and the history of Chile ever since has been to try to correct for those excesses. And yet, with this recent election, with Milei taking power, you know, it seems like his agenda looks and feels a lot like what Chile adopted in the 70s and 80s. Am I missing the point on all of this?
No, I think that there's two things here. One, you know, I think that you hit on perhaps one of the great debates in both Argentine historiography and amongst Argentinians in the present, which is how much of the sort of economic crises that the country has faced in the past 2 to 3 decades is the consequence of Perón and Perónism, and how much of it is a consequence of policies adopted and implemented by the dictatorship itself.
In response to Perón.
In response to rising leftism and sort of the era of revolution that swept across much of the region in the 20th century. Now, that then brings us to Chile. And the sort of second point here is it's not so much that Chile adopted neoliberalism, whereas neoliberalism was forced upon Chileans at the point of a gun, at the point of a military willing to turn its weaponry against its own citizenry.
Right.
And, you know, and this is where sort of
assisted by American professors, let's be clear.
Assisted by American professors, by the American government in terms of its willingness to recognize the Pinochet dictatorship, right? The CIA in terms of the coup, all of these things, right? And it's almost, you know, one thing I was thinking about is that the 90s in Chile is almost very similar to what's happening in the present-day Argentina vis-a-vis neoliberalism.
How so?
Right, so Chile coming out of the 1980s and the strength of a sort of pro-democracy movement does defeat the dictatorship at the ballot box. Then, however, the 90s arrives and much of the neoliberal policies that are put into place, the sort of five pillars, as they're sometimes called, in relation to the economy and society and the Constitution, are by and large left in place in the 1990s.
Well, let's bring in the specter of the United States, right? Because for nearly two centuries, the United States has had this weirdly coercive influence on Argentina and on Chile, where occasionally the U.S. will take direct action to alter the politics and economics of these states. It goes back to the guano wars of the 19th century, right?
Totally.
Where the U.S. just, you know, is desperate to get guano, to get shit to use for fertilizer, right? It's like that. And now, looking forward to the next two centuries, to a lithium-based economy if we end up all driving electric cars and whatnot. And here we have, in Argentina, a tremendous amount of lithium in the ground, potentially leading to the resource curse that we've seen in petroleum-based nations around the world in the 20th century, where it's almost impossible to hold up democracy once you discover oil, right? And so should we be worried about the future, especially a future that might include Donald Trump, with the United States taking a deeper interest in exploiting the natural resources of these countries?
Yeah, I was really struck by the way that they chose to end the interview and sort of remind us as citizens of North America, sort of our own culpability and the role that Trump and Trumpism has really played in the rise of what, you know, outlets have referred to as Latin America's new hard right. It's not just that it's extracting natural resources, but also all of the environmental knock-on effects of this extraction, right? And where the lithium is located, right, is in deeply indigenous lands and on the lands of indigenous persons, right? And so there is a sort of myriad of struggles that lithium is a quilting point that we could think about here.
Wow. I would love to go a day without thinking about Donald Trump or Elon Musk.
Wouldn't we all?
But sadly, today is not that day. Well, thank you again, Nick. Look, that's all we have right now for this episode of Democracy in Danger. We're going to be posting rebroadcasts during our off weeks. Next up, please catch up on the role of Black intellectual leaders in American democracy.
We have to move the soul to this sort of moral and political rectitude, and that was what Ida B. Wells sought to do.
Stay in touch in the meantime. Shoot us a tweet at DND Podcast. That's D-I-N-D Podcast. And visit our website, dindanger.org.
We have a lot more new stuff coming your way this season. We will have an episode on Nicaragua, one on Senegal, and one on the legacy of Japanese relocation centers during World War II.
Democracy in Danger is produced by Robert Armengol, Stephen Betts, Ariana Aronson, and me. Adine Yeager engineers the show. Our interns are Charlie Burns, Lena Freyhat, Katie Pyle, Makhdu Murad Shah, and Caroline Yu. We have help from Ellie Sabatiera.
Support comes from the University of Virginia's College of Arts and Sciences. The show is a project of UVA's Karsh Institute of Democracy. We're distributed by the Virginia Audio Collective of WTJU Radio in Charlottesville. I'm Siva Vaidyanathan.
And I'm Nicholas Scott. Will Hitchcock will be back in a fortnight.
Thank you for listening to this episode from the Democracy Group. If you want more podcasts like this, then visit democracygroup.org. There you will find our events, topics, and a newsletter as well. So head on over to democracygroup.org.